The challenge that I've seen is that if you get a top-down mandate, and the folks that are on the ground, the boots on the ground, don't really understand the why or the how, it's a mandate. If you have a bottoms-up approach and folks understand it and they get behind it, usually that success will trickle up in a more productive manner than it would trickle down.
Hey everyone, I'm Sandy Robinson, your host of RevOps Unboxed. During each episode, we're diving headfirst into conversations with some of the most incredible RevOps leaders out there. Not CEOs, not big flashy executives, not vendors. We're talking to the people who are actually doing the work, the ones leading teams, the ones in the trenches, grinding it out every single day. We're taking things up a notch, getting deeper, having more fun, and as always, keeping it real. Remember our theme, RevOps Unboxed, and today we're unboxing it all. Let's get started. Hey everyone, I'm Sandy Robinson. I'm your host of RevOps Unboxed, and today I'm here with Lonnie Sternberg. He is a RevOps and GTM professional. He's been in the industry for over 12 years, and today he's going to drop some knowledge. I'm so excited for you to be here, Lonnie. Thank you so much for joining.
Sandy, super excited. Thanks so much for having me. I am inspired by the content as well as the topic that we're going to dive into today. I've been leading revenue operations for 12 plus years, really focusing on the revenue engines required to build a go-to-market excellence, penetrate markets, and grow revenues, particularly scaling anywhere from zero to one to $100+ million. So zero to one startup and then 100 plus million, you know, the scale up emerging technology companies, specifically B2B SaaS. So thank you again for having me. Super excited.
Great, great. Yeah, you know, tell me a little bit more about your background. I noticed you like me, I think started out on the sales side of things and then found yourself in the operations, down the road. So can you tell me a little bit about how you got your start and what brought you to RevOps?
Absolutely. So I got bit by the RevOps bug, I'd say, prior to RevOps being as much RevOps as it is today, which is really awesome and great to see that the community is growing. We're continuing to redefine who we are as not only operators but specific cross-functional leaders and experts. Started off with a small private company that had a unique competitive advantage in the marketplace with a voice over IP, not only technology but then built out their own individual network. So there's a little bit of hardware and software. So there was a small operational component there, but it was a SaaS business very clearly. And once learning and growing and adding a lot of value to that organization, I moved to, your traditional B2B SaaS startup, zero to one. And it's being a startup in a smaller organization, having to define your ICP, define a go-to-market strategy, build out all of the infrastructure, all of the rules, understand the compliance, the cross-functional leadership, et cetera, had to wear many different hats like many of us. And it was an awesome experience. And I was holding the title of operations as well as revenue operations, reporting into the CEO, working very closely with the board as well as the other stakeholders in the organization. So with that said, revenue operations was the core, the center, and the forefront. It was just a little bit less defined. And then as I matured in my career, as well as in that organization, the role, the definition, the sales, the company grew, and there became more specializations, hence leading me to where I am today as a revenue operations leader.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like, pre-21, I don't even know that people were even using the term revenue operations. So much like you, my role was actually more defined as sales operations, but it included everything, right? This was, back in 2012, 13, 14, and, it was everything from, the marketing side of things. How do we do compensation? How do we deal with ongoing customer issues? So it was spanning the full customer journey, but even sales ops was kind of new back then, but
right.
But that I just find it interesting because everybody gets to RevOps differently. I'm finding I talked to somebody the other day who was a lawyer, and I was like, "Huh, that's a new one. That's great for deal desk. Like you can talk to lawyers, but you know." Those kind of things really, you know, some folks come from the finance side, some folks come from the operations side, or they start as analysts. I've even talked to somebody who was an SDR and just like really got into the tools and then got into sales ops and then kind of went from there. So I just like to hear, because I think people listening appreciate that, since RevOps, as you mentioned, is evolving and understanding kind of how everybody got there. So it's
definitely, I agree. And I think today with, you know, looking and thinking more of this larger bow tie model and this very clear lens that we have to use to navigate, what makes RevOps leaders, you know, very effective is that there's a lot of diversity, a lot of background, a lot of perspectives to apply to add a lot of value that way.
Ooh, I love the bow tie. I just love that you said that because I think it's so important. I think there's an hourglass out there too, which is literally the bow tie. It's like, you're sideways for that. And I'm like, dude, the hourglass is just the bow tie standing up. It's the same thing. It's the same thing, dude. But yeah, I think it's important to look at that. So whatever your title is, kind of doesn't matter. It's really your, I think, span of control and span of influence that matters. In terms of RevOps, I've talked to people, they're called of like head of revenue strategy or even a chief of staff sometimes is a RevOps leader, right?
100%. I think that's great perspective. And, you know, actually part of a conversation yesterday, the more I read most recently in conversations is that it's the scope is expanding to really consider a lot more finance today. And I think corporate governance, and there's a lot of other different areas, which I think the value is being created by understanding, you know, the P&L and really the different parts of the landscape, not just your, I would say the initial success sales and, marketing side of things, but it's, there's much more in today's environment. That is simplifying, but also adding a lot of complexities. So might be a topic in itself.
I think so. I think so for sure. No, this is good stuff. I appreciate your insight. And, you know, we got to actually be engaged on LinkedIn because of a somewhat controversial post that I put up, which, boy, I would never do that. I would never create, I'd never be a trouble starter ever, ever, ever. Where I asked a question about CRM, and there was a lot of commentary on my post. And, you know, one of the things that I'm doing, I'm looking to potentially make a switch. I'm not going to get into the details of my problem right now, but I think it brought up a great conversation. You know, there's a number of choices out there. There's ways to approach these things. And a lot of times when companies bring in RevOps leaders, they're coming in either early to build it from the ground up, which requires CRM evaluation, or they're coming in to fix a mess, which potentially could require a CRM evaluation because, you know, I'll give you an example. I came in a prior company, I came into a mess with a certain CRM and we decided to just revamp and fix it, essentially build a new instance. But it would have been just as easy to switch solutions because of how much work we had to do. So we didn't consider that because there were internal biases, but, you know, I don't know. I think it's a good conversation. So I love that you want to talk about this topic and I would love to hear some insights from, you know, this idea of graduating from a spreadsheet to a full-blown CRM. So where do you want to start?
Yeah, I love the idea that you started with the recognizing this concept of the internal bias, right? Because I think that there's experiences, which are great. But there's also, to your point, I think if we break it down, there's a macro and there's a micro. Mm-hmm. You know, the micro, we could bucket and say that there is, you know, well, this is what we've done. This is why we've made these decisions. This is kind of a bias, whether you're inside the org or new to the org and bringing, you know, what's worked for you in the past. And then I think the macro is that concept of like, where are we headed? Like, what's our target state and where do we want to go and thinking long term? And I think that's the framework for the big two topics. Am I graduating, to your point, from a spreadsheet into a CRM and we're going to formalize this? Or do I have an existing infrastructure? And what's the switching, what I call the switching costs? Okay. Mm-hmm. The unrecognized dollars or opportunity costs of making the transition. And between those two spots, there's all this internal bias or knowledge. And often in the latter part where there's more infrastructure already in place, a CRM of choice has been chosen and led with, there's maybe been 2, 3, 4 plus admins or delegated admins, just depending on the organizational structure. So you're asking yourself, you know, is it pay to change and to modify, mm-hmm. to edit the instance, or just let's say retool, let's call refactor, or do we just start, you know, blank? And I think that's what's got everybody talking about this today, mm-hmm. which is one of the 3 or 4 major topics in the industry today is like, mm-hmm. hey, do we go with X, Y, Z vendor? And mm-hmm. so I'm excited today to tear down, like, what are those components that maybe you, Sandy, will be looking at or others should consider amongst other things. We won't cover everything. To help with that evaluation criteria to decide, you know, what's going to be best for the business, what's going to, of course, most importantly, promote collective success, and then what's also going to have the largest form of ROI.
Yeah, and you mentioned there may have been 4 or 5 admins. There also could have been 4 or 5 sales leaders or revenue leaders, right? So what I've seen in pretty much every scenario, even a startup that I joined that didn't have an old instance of Salesforce, is that, you know, sales leaders want to see this thing now. And the answer is tell admin to add field to get whatever they want.
You know,
it's like, yeah. Oh my God, really? Like, and then it's like, there's field. I saw, okay, I'm not lying about this. Like, instead of using campaigns, this particular deal record or opportunity record that I was looking at had a drop down box,
yes.
Literally for every year they went to this trade show. So it was like, 2019 trade show, click. And I'm like, oh my God, you're going to put one in every, like, like, you know, it's no wonder there were 266 fields sitting there on the deal. Like, holy cow. So
sure.
Your point, sometimes it just gets so out of control. You're like, what do I do? It might be easier to just start over, blow it up.
100%. I agree. Yeah. So some of the things I think that you just touched on, you know, just dive in a little bit deeper, is what comes to my mind, at least when you mentioned that, is not great point. Different admins, different sales leaders, but the, you know, as the revenue grows in the business, the ICP can be changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the functionality or the requirements of the offering and the delivery could be changing. And what we need to capture on the front end, you know, if we look at a classic vertical funnel, what we need to capture in the sales process and the motion to be able to empower, you know, activation, or to be in empower success down the road, or any type of renewal information could be changing. And during that process, I too have experienced that exact same scenario where, okay, we're maxed out on fields. What does all this mean? And when having the conversation with sales leadership and others, it takes, a calm set of factors to say, okay, why do we really need this? Is this a management objective? Or is this really necessary that of data that we collect? And I see that a lot in stages, particularly. And there was a comment last week that I posted on, and so, you know, like, what is the importance of lead source, et cetera. But stages often, I think, can be used very deliberately to help expand and grow the business because there's consistency. And then using action items or some other form, you know, within dynamic layouts, et cetera, to be able to say, you know, these are the objectives. This is what changes with these product lines, et cetera. And I think that starts to evolve in a way that builds maturity versus trying to have like 100,000 fields. Well, we need this to your point. Well, we need this field for this conference. We need this field for this one, versus trying to optimize around that. So, but basically, yeah, I think those key factors, right? ICP, is the ICP going to change? You know, what are the billing models too? That was another thing that came to mind when you and I were talking through LinkedIn, and our conversation was, you know, what's going on in this usage or consumption based thing over the next 2 to 5 years? And are we ready? Are we prepared for that? Is our CRM going to support it? So I think, you know, love to hear what your thoughts are in terms of your eval, like, you know, where's the business model going and how you're considering those things.
Yeah, I think I try to look at the bigger picture. I think people get pretty pigeonholed into pipeline management, pipeline functionality. And that's a lot of times because that's the focus of pressure on the revenue team is the sales part of the revenue journey where, you know, we've got to close new logos. We've got to get our upsells. Mm-hmm. We've got to get our cross sells. And so pipeline management becomes the focus and the CRM becomes a pipeline tool. And I look at it as a customer, like customer relationship management.
Yeah, it's a whole journey, right?
Hello. So in terms of, you know, requirements and functionality, I think there's the short-term need, which is what a lot of us get focused on, especially, you know, we're cramming in, you know, for those of us who are on a calendar fiscal year, you know, it's like, Thanksgiving's here. Everybody's freaking out, or we've got to close these deals the rest of the quarter. Nobody's even worried about pipeline for Q1. I mean, I am, but it just gets very hyper-focused on pipeline. So when you're looking at evaluations, that's a critical factor, but I think it's things like, even if you're a startup, what does full customer journey look like down the road? Customer success team, even if you don't have one yet, you want to set it up to where however you're setting up your tool or whatever tool you're choosing is going to support that or support some level of integration that will allow you to do that. Your proprietary solutions, as if you're in a SaaS company that you sell, can you feed that data right into your CRM? And how difficult is that to set up? Mm-hmm. To where you can get those usage reports and understand so you don't have to go to other places. And I think those are the bigger things. You have on your list CPQ, quote to cash. I mean, that's critical, especially if you have complex pricing and any level of redlining negotiations. What does a deal desk look like? And what does that look like? So I think those all have to be requirements. If you're looking at putting in a new CRM, and the thing I think people forget, maybe they don't forget, they just assume it's the same for every tool. And I'll tell you right now, it's freaking not, is what email platform do you use? And how is all of that set up in your company, your SSO? Those are big considerations that I think sometimes are afterthoughts. Because it's very different if you're an Outlook shop versus a Gmail shop, right?
The security
very,
settings,
very different.
All the monitoring, are you in a highly regulated space? Spam filtering, you know, if it's, you know, it could be email inbound, it could be outbound, it could be, you know, servicing. But 100%, I think those are all really, really great bullet points for sure.
Yeah. So how do you approach making these decisions? Like, what do you suggest people do in their?
Yeah. So the one thing that came to the one thing that just triggered when you said that I thought was a sensational point was, I think that there's a lot of learning and cross-functional collaboration and communication that needs to be taken into consideration up front. So are you going to be doing ETL, reverse ETL? Is there going to be some form or level of API? Is it custom API? And when you brought up this really, really, really great point about thinking about the entire journey, so not just the initial sales pipeline, so akin to quarter four 2024 versus quarter one 2025, is that what information do we need or are we collecting, say, during the sales process or immediately after, that enables two major components of revenue generating activity? One being success. So is it renewal revenue and how are we managing that information? Or is there cross-sell, upsell opportunity evolution that can occur within the sale that we're piping in from those proprietary systems, so that when we're back on the front lines selling earlier on, we have that information. Mm-hmm. If it's user feedback, if it's data, if it's interaction, if it's call volume, if it's ticket related, but to your exact point, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head, Sandy, where it's like, yeah, this is to generate new, but what is the definition of ARR? It's recurring revenue, right? So how are we piping that data in, and how are we going to design and map that data flow? So we can not necessarily, we'll leave like the, you know, center of truth off the table for now, but just how is that information democratized?
Right.
And does it inform that sale? And that's something that I really, you know, hit. And, you know, being, you know, a large user of Salesforce historically, you know, security has become a really big thing. And are you using an external security infrastructure to, you know, be the oversight inside of your CRM? Does it have something integrated? Are you bound by, you know, SOC 2 audits and PII governance, et cetera? And I think those types of considerations, to your point, they're not a revenue generating necessary activity on the security side, but it's a preventative component. But there's a soft cost to people worrying about that throughout the entire sales cycle. That all has to be a consideration in that model.
Yeah, I agree. And it has to go, you know, I have a rubric I use and it for all my tech evaluation. And I try to make sure I get all the stakeholders involved. And one of them is your, you know, whoever on your CISO team is handling that sort of stuff and evaluations, obviously internal procurement and all the other box checky people, but security is critical, especially, you know, you're depending on the type of data that you're planning to house in there or even connect to, those things are super important. And so it needs to be, I think, part of the CRM evaluation. It needs to be weighted highly. And you made a great point, the cross-functional team that's looking at it.
100%.
You know, because not everybody, depending on where you, like we said before, RevOps, it could be a cluster, it could be everywhere. You could be, you know, running the CRM evaluation, but it impacts, you know, multiple people across the organization. So I think it's important to get those teams. I'll give you an example. We're putting together these account teams, and there are folks that will support our customers on the several are on the revenue team, several are on different teams, but they're all part of a essentially customer team. So we have to make sure that we are considering their needs, and we are a heavy Jira company. So on my evaluation sheet, it's how does the Jira integration work? What does that look like? And what level of integration can that provide? Can it, you know, map up to the customer record? Like, what does that actually look like? So that's going to be an important consideration for us, because Jira is not going anywhere in our company, like not. And so that's how we manage our tickets, and our account teams are going to need to see, at least see that stuff. Right. So, So I just like the point you brought up on that cross-functional collaboration, and, you know, who else do you think should be involved in this stuff? You know, if you're thinking about either ripping and replacing or, putting in a something from nothing.
Yeah, I think so. Security, we talked about definitely everybody involved in the go-to-market success, sales, marketing. I think there's needs to be very, very, very close integrations, because a lot of organizations lately have been wanting to kind of split the instance, if you will, on the marketing side versus the actual, you know, bringing the dollars in hard selling side, which is, can be interesting at times. Mm-hmm. Those components. So marketing, success, sales, security. I think anybody that is going to be engaged and it's going to touch the customer. And then what I found a lot of success in, Sandy, was really talking to the folks, depending on the size of the organization. So traditionally, I have been, you know, anywhere 0 to 4+ 100 people, but the larger the organization, sometimes these software platforms, obviously the CRM topic today is managed a lot of times on the smaller side in-house, but it might go to a business unit that says, hey, we manage this technical infrastructure. So the data team, I think, is somebody that you really want to get close to early on and say, hey, do we have a data dictionary? Do we have standard terms? Do we have a standard for our API naming conventions or fields or some other form? Because I've been in this situation a few different times where, you know, tomato is not tomato.
And right.
They're very different things. And you know, there's not a unique identifier across these different ecosystems. So when you're looking to make a very important business decision, or it comes time to do a recon between finance and RevOps and sales, or you're building a new commission plan or a new sales comp structure for 2025, and you're like, wait a second, I have 4 and you have 7 arbitrary numbers, but what's the unique identifier so we can balance this out? And there is none.
Giving me anxiety here.
I'll be here to support you.
I need a couch to sit on because I've been through this twice, the unique identifier, and you're right, like, you've got to get the right people involved. And you know, if you have a bigger company that's been around longer, you're probably gonna have to map some shit together, right? You're not gonna you're not gonna end up with this one unique identifier. At least in the beginning, you're gonna have to determine, like, some sort of you know, I'm sure, you know, whatever the data warehouse, wherever it's gonna be, some mapping configuration. But yeah, I mean, if you're starting this from scratch, like, the parent-child hierarchy and the unique identifier, that's the key to everything. And you have to really consider, like, how do you get those unique identifiers? Yeah. I'll give you an example in a prior world, not my most recent one, the one before that. We did a really good job of getting multiple teams together to figure out how we create a unique identifier and what the parent-child hierarchy was. There were some limitations with our proprietary products, which is when we would sell the product, we would set up an instance of that particular product. Mm-hmm. And that would, mm-hmm. that had a numeric limitation on numbers.
Yep.
And sure. You could potentially sell a customer 2 versions of that. So we wrote our parent-child rules around that, so that way, and then we generated the unique code from Salesforce, but we used the requirements of our product to make sure it would fit that. And it took some time, but we got alignment organizationally. But that was not an older company that had to, like, unwind a bunch of stuff. It wasn't easy, but it was, you know, we were able to get alignment on it. You know, so, but that was, like, a good scenario. I have also an example of a really bad one that I don't want to talk about. So, but anyway, so I love that you recommend that, like thinking about those unique identifiers, because that's going to be important for your migration, right? First of all, when you're setting it up, and then looking at whatever the CRM is and the capabilities of mapping all of that, because they are different.
Yeah. Well, so I think using, you know, jumping off on that, you know, and just kind of looking at some of the topic outline for today, what comes to mind that you brought up that I also think is a consideration, and we'll shift away from like the stack, if you will, right? And let's talk a little bit about if it works for you is the EQ. Mm-hmm. Involved in all of this, because I think the influence without authority, change management, you know, current state versus target state are all considerations when thinking about these platforms. So, you know, is there sponsorship, right, cross-functionally between the different levels of the organization? Is everybody committed to the same goals, let's call it? Because while there may be, you know, a hierarchy of OKRs or, you know, some objectives, et cetera, what everybody wants out of the platform may be something different. So I think that right. If there's a common unifying goal to say like, hey, we have a singular, very simplified objective that has to be met or exceeded coming out of these platforms that every, you know, whether it be revenue or a different department, can know that we're delivering a delightful experience, a world-class experience, mm-hmm. then we have that adoption, and we have that emotional intelligence that's needed from every leader, and we have buy-in. I think that's really, really important. And then we get into the usability components of it, the UI, the UX, and the UAT. So for example, you know, on the sales side of it, it just needs to work, right? It's got to be easy. It's got to be fast. It just has to work. But, you know, those teams have to also understand, I think it's important that they're partnering too to say, hey, let's do UAT. Do we have proper enablement? Do we have proper sales operations infrastructure? Do we lead with the why to understand why we need to do these things, why it's important? Are we managing through those stages? So I think that's a consideration of selection criteria, is that if you have a user base that is, you know, used to, for example, Salesforce, or they're, you know, hey, we've all been using HubSpot before, or we have a super simplified, we don't need all of these details. What's not going to be the path of least resistance, but what is going to naturally, within the design, or the UI, the UX of the CRM, lend itself more organically to that sales motion? And mm-hmm. to that business model. And I think that there are definitely some influences within the design and the makeup of these CRMs and other platforms. There's a lot more intelligence than there used to be. It's not just, you know, throwing features in, but really right. thinking through, you know, specifically, is this a software B2B SaaS type of organization? Or are you more of a service business? Mm-hmm. Do you require more customizations? Are you working with a lot of third parties that you need to be able to just go build something, you know, from the ground up and use Soquel or something else? So I think those are I think, you know, more of the softer side of the things that we don't focus on as much that I think are contributing factors.
Yeah, I think the EQ, I mean, I think it honestly starts from the top down, right? You know, it's been my experience that sometimes leaders, they just have biases. There was one that I encountered that was basically like, you were not allowed to even say the word Salesforce. And like, you just couldn't. And it's like, it was because, you know, 100 years ago, they were way more expensive than the other tools that are now out there. But now sure. these tools are all kind of, you know, they're not as cheap as they used to be, the Salesforce competitors. And so, but it was an emotional reaction because they had, you know, whatever experience that's baked in their brain, and they're like, nope, done, don't want it, don't talk about it. And I'm like, you're defying logic right now. This makes no sense. You know, you have to take the emotions out of it. But, you know, how do you find that you're able to do that? Can you do that from the bottom up in an org, or does it have to be from the top down?
Yeah, I think I like that question a lot. I think there's different advantages of both ways, bottom up and top down. And I think that the challenge that I've seen is that if you get a top down mandate, and the folks that are on the ground, the boots on the ground, don't really understand the why or the how, it's a mandate. If you have a bottoms up approach and folks understand it and they get behind it, usually that success will trickle up in a more productive manner than it would trickle down. I think it's important in both scenarios to ensure that everybody's aware of the contribution and the cost of collective success that it comes from everybody. That a top-down leader can't just snap their fingers and say, "I want this data. I need to be able to measure these things." Da 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 da. Right? Because if they're not grounded in understanding the disciplines and supporting the disciplines along that whole journey to get the information to be able to even calculate or support it, it's not going to be there. It's that simple. But if the folks are doing the work or saying, "Hey, this is too difficult and I can't get my job done. I can't do these things because it's so hard to navigate," then that top-down leadership can just be like, "Hey, why do we have this friction in our business where people feel like they can't get anything done?" And the miss, I think, in the middle, it's trust and communication. And that's why I think if you can get your levels of different leadership engaged to your point and really like, "Hey, what are your pain points? What are you trying to solve? Here's what we're trying to achieve." And you can have like this principle of, first team principles on a leadership or executive team, really getting behind it. There's not a lot of really areas to run and hide. And I think that then you can build a bottoms up that usually will trickle up a little bit more. And then you're not being told as much, but you're managing way up and effectively influencing without authority and saying, "Hey, we're doing this. This is the objective. So tell me the objective. Hit me with a problem statement. Give me a prompt, and then let's go work together and let's knock it out of the park." So that's a lot of times I think what I have tried to do is more of that bottoms up a little bit more. Unless you have a top down that really gets it.
I think I think the old school, like, oh, we're gonna do this and everyone's just gonna do it and we've made the decision, I think that doesn't work. I think the bottoms up is critical. You have to collaborate, you have to get the input, and like you said, like things like user experience and getting even getting salespeople involved, getting SDRs involved, getting the actual people who are going to freaking use it involved. Like I look at that as that bottoms up and that evaluation and everything. The only problem that I see with strictly a bottoms up is if you don't have the executive sponsorship, you're totally screwed. So I think there has to be some level of, hey, the CEO's got Lonnie's back on this. This is a Q1 initiative. Here's who's on first, and this is the way it needs to go. I think without that, it's, I don't think it were. I think without that executive sponsorship, so without some level of C-suite, not just buy-in, because I've had conversations where like C-suite's like, oh yeah, this is great, go for it, yes, this sounds awesome,
They
but
need to give you the authority and the autonomy.
yes, they need to
Period.
say,
You have to have it. You have to have it because you can't be. And I've hit that roadblock, frankly, a lot. Where it's like, yeah, it's their initiative, they got it, but it's like, no, I, we don't. It's not about power. It's about collective success. But it's and it's just. But you got to give that autonomy and that authority. And hold people accountable, I think, both sides to your exact point. And if there's not any, or there's very little of it, then it just becomes a very, very cyclical saga.
Yes. There are other terms that I won't use for that, but I think it's a very common scenario that RevOps folks run into where you're just kind of running in circles and chasing your tail if you don't have that, whether it's part of your company blueprint or if you have a rock and
Yeah,
it's
sure.
something that everybody is accountable to and that everybody has gotten on board with after you've done whatever the evaluation is, right? Because you've gotten these people and then you've gotten sign off, gone through whatever process, and now they have to help you support your efforts. You're the one driving this. It also helps if you can get a PM, if there's a chief of staff,
Yeah, I love having a PM function inside of RevOps.
Like if you can borrow some, if you have a PMO team in your organization, you can borrow one to help you drive your whatever your initiative is. And this isn't just for CRM, like this is for anything RevOps wants to do, right? It could
100%,
be
yeah.
a new tool, it could be a go-to-market motion, a new initiative that's happening. I think a lot of lessons, even if you're listening to this and you're not evaluating a quote CRM, if you're really doing something that, like you said earlier, Lonnie, like change management, that's really our jobs, right? In RevOps is we are brought in to typically to scale and grow an organization and to enable teams to do that. And that's going to require change. And whether that you're a startup or company who's been around for 20 years and has a bunch of ugly skeletons and things that you didn't know that were there, every company is going to experience some change when you have a RevOps team that is trying to push everybody forward. Because I think ultimately that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to push people forward. And it requires a level of coordination and getting the stakeholder buy-in. And you said, communication. I think you brought a great point on that. So I think we could continue this. Maybe we need to have a part two. But I would love for you to kind of leave us here with some takeaways for the listeners. These are folks who are, all levels of RevOps, marketing ops, sales ops, CS ops, analysts listening to this. What are some sort of I don't know if you have a mantra or words, some key tips that you like to leave with folks, but I'd like to wrap up and hear that from you.
Yeah, I think that the theme of this conversation has been, I think, framework is putting together a framework for digesting the problem that you're trying to solve, whether it be CRM or something else, and focusing on just really understanding the problem set and talking to everybody is part of evaluating that problem. And if I go back to the framework of following the problem, okay, we've got the problem identified. We know it backwards and forwards. There could be multiple solutions. There might be two, three, four. And this is something I have to remind myself, is that we're seeking perfection, but in the process, we're going to get excellence. And if you make two work and two wasn't the best, was better than nothing, maybe it's not as good as number three, and then execute. And execute, and everyone says, oh, go fast, go fast, go fast, right? And I think fast is important, but I'm a big, big, big proponent of I appreciate, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And then build that culture of continuous learning where you have executed and you get it going. And if it's wrong, like you'll just make it better. You'll fix it. So if you end up picking two and three was better, well, two again is better than zero. You've advanced, and then you end up at three, you're still farther ahead.
Right.
than you would have been. So I think that if you understand your framework going in, you use that framework to evaluate the problem. Again, you pick possible solutions, you evaluate those, you pick one, and then you drive forward. I think those are in that process, if you're communicating and going through each step and following your framework, then you are building that consensus, you're building that transformation, you're building that change management, you're building the trust, you're forcing yourself through some form of rubric or discipline to do that. And most of the time, then now you've built that bottoms up, top down, hybrid, or all the above naturally. And then I think that's what you help become a really, really, really good leader.
Awesome. I am going to leave it at that, Lonnie. That was a great way to wrap up the show today. I think there were quite a few nuggets of wisdom here that you shared. I really appreciate you joining the podcast today.
And thanks for having me.
Yes, for sure. And I'm sure we'll be continuing our conversation on LinkedIn or elsewhere. So thanks so much for joining. And thanks, everyone, for listening today. Really appreciate you. Look forward to some comments on this episode. And thanks for joining. Take care.
Talk soon, Sandy.
This has been another episode of RevOps Unboxed in partnership with the Revenue Operations Alliance. Until next time, keep unboxing.